Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. This week, we honor the late civil rights activist, philanthropist, and ambassador, James C. Hormel, who died August 13th at age 88. He made history as the highest-ranking openly gay U.S. official when he became ambassador to Luxembourg in 1999, after a long, contentious political battle. An heir to the Hormel Foods fortune, he was very generous to LGBTQ causes and a big donor to Democrats after his young years as an outwardly hetero Republican. He shared highlights of his fascinating life story with Out in the Bay in 2011. In his honor and memory, we bring you parts of that conversation, complete with our theme music from that time. Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, Our Lives, Our Voices. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, my guest is philanthropist and former ambassador to Luxembourg, James C. Hormel. The Gay and Lesbian Center at the San Francisco Public Library bears his name, as he was one of the center's instigators and major donors. He was appointed ambassador by President Bill Clinton in 1999 after a years-long and ugly battle with ultra-conservatives, religious conservatives, so ugly that they even accused him of being a pedophile. Born in Austin, Minnesota in 1933, son of the head of Hormel Foods, makers of Spam, among other meat products, he grew up in a place and time in which gay wasn't really a viable option. After marrying, fathering five children, and becoming a law school dean, all while still in the closet, he eventually found himself and went on to become a political and social activist, philanthropist, and ambassador. His memoir is called Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. He's here with me live in the studio to talk about his book and his quite interesting life. Ambassador James Hormel, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you very much for having me.
When I started reading your book, I was reminded of a comic book character from my childhood in the 1960s, Richie Rich, the poor little rich boy, who had no friends because he lived in an isolated compound. And your childhood, according to your book at least, was similar in some ways. You lived in a 26-bedroom mansion, the only one in Austin, Minnesota at that time, on a 200-acre estate out of town. And on top of that, you began to realize that you were different in other ways. This is back in the 1930s, shortly after the kidnapping and eventual murder of aviator Charles Lindbergh's child.
Yeah.
So you and your brothers were kept under constant watch.
Well, needless to say, I don't remember
because right,
I was 6 months old at the time. But there was a person who was arrested in Iowa and somehow or other tied to an attempted kidnap, and they found on his person a slip of paper that had my name on it. And that led to, you know, really strong precautionary measures at home, understandably. And so I didn't remember a time in my childhood when there wasn't an armed guard around or some surveillance of some kind. And it made it very uncomfortable.
And so you had that sort of isolation. You didn't really have playmates in town, right?
It was difficult because we lived outside of town, and the only way I could get back and forth was in a car that was driven by somebody in uniform, and it was just very awkward. So occasionally I would be able to get together with other kids or they would come out, but it was hard.
In school, you were sort of teased a little bit. Was it kind of a, you know, oh, this the rich Hormel kid? And you talked about the smell from the plant at certain times of year would come in through the school windows, and it was quite a stench, and they'd kind of blame you. Or
I related a story about one day when the wind was blowing the wrong way from the packing plant, and the smells that came out of the hide cellar, which were really dreadful, sort of wafted into a classroom. And this was when I was in, oh, I would guess third grade, and one of the kids said in a stage whisper, "Well, it smells like old man Hormel has his feet out the window again." I was so embarrassed, I tried to sort of convey that I didn't notice. But I got home and told my father about it, and he thought it was very funny. He said, "Well, you tell him the next time he says that, that he should have been around when my grandfather was in town."
What was the packing plant like? Did you go there much as a kid?
It was an amazing place because it consisted of, I think, 190 separate buildings that were all connected in one way or another. And the industry in those days operated with gravity so that animals went up a ramp to the slaughtering floor, and then it was sort of a reverse assembly line. It was a disassembly line, and parts flowed down with gravity along chutes and escalators and whatever till they got to the ground floor and they were fully processed.
Wow, sounds like quite an operation, to say the least. You had this somewhat isolated childhood, and then you had some French and some English kids come to live with you during the war because they were fleeing the war going on in their countries.
That's correct, yes. And that was really horrible. We don't have a concept, because we've all lived past the Civil War, of the destruction of war in this country. We haven't really been hit by it except for Pearl Harbor. So my godmother, who was English, sent her children to live with us, and her niece came, and my two cousins from France, and we were all kids growing up within a sort of age range of 7 years or so, and we didn't talk about what they had already seen when they arrived, but we paid a lot of attention to what was happening.
I'm curious to know when your attraction to other boys became obvious to you.
Well, at that time, it could have been obvious if I had wanted to really admit to it. But what was equally obvious to me was that that was not the way society operated, especially in the 40s. So I resisted my impulses, and I thought of myself as being strange, and I was never told, you know, gay is bad. I was never told gay is wrong. People didn't talk about sex at all. I went to an all-boys school, and there was, you know, constant attraction around me. And I didn't feel so much that way in college, especially when I went to Swarthmore, which was a co-ed school, approximately half women. And I very soon met someone who was attractive to me, and we developed a relationship that turned into our marriage.
Mm-hmm. So at the time, did you have reservations about getting married?
I firmly wanted to believe that my attraction to men would pass. I just thought that Alice and I had a love that was strong enough that it would carry us.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this in the book. During your marriage and while you were dean of students at the University of Chicago Law School, you had rendezvous with other men, right?
I did.
And you mentioned in the book that kind of it was sort of easier than you thought it would be to sort of find places or find men. And even though it wasn't spoken about, it was not that difficult in a way?
Well, you know, people joke about gaydar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's not a joke. I mean, there really is a sensibility or a sensitivity that manifests itself in some form that I cannot describe. Mm-hmm. But it was not difficult to identify people who were either gay or bisexual or willing to experiment. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mention in the book also that you had been encouraged to run for Congress, I believe it was at that time, right?
Yes.
And contemplated it, but feared that your sexual activities might be exposed either during your campaign or while you were in office if you were elected. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
In the 50s, there was a concerted effort to expose gay people in the government, in Washington in particular. And that began in the State Department.
Mm-hmm. The Lavender Scare, it was called?
It caused a lot of people to end their careers mm-hmm. in government service. And that went on and through the 50s and 60s, very publicly. Senator Joe McCarthy used gay people as a foil. The common accusation was you couldn't trust them mm-hmm. with secrets, that they could be blackmailed, tricked into exposing information, even though in those 20 years from roughly 1950 to 1970, there wasn't one single case of that kind of activity, not one.
So back in this time in Chicago, you were Republican then, and I'm curious to know how conservative you were and how different the Republican Party was at that time than it is today.
Well, there was a spectrum of Republicanism in the party, and it went from, you know, what we see today to what one would have to call liberal, I mean, beyond moderate. So there was an element of the party which I found attractive, And then Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65, and suddenly there was a great migration of Democrats, mainly from the South, mm-hmm. into the Republican Party. And the party's attitudes shifted dramatically, so that people like Senator McCarthy, who was no longer around by then, began to look like Republican leaders. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the end of it for me. I couldn't cope with the hypocrisy that started to crop up. You know, the big tent is one thing, but the limits of prejudice, when they seep through the entire party, I couldn't stay with it anymore.
One of your jobs at the University of Chicago Law School was to bring in more minority students, right?
Well, I made it my job. Mm-hmm. I really was appalled that there were so few women and so few minorities in the law school. There was a reason for it. And the reason was that law firms had their own traditional patterns of hiring, and they were often almost exclusively white males.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a trip that you'd taken to the Deep South at one point and really being having an eye-opening experience at some of the extreme poverty that you saw there. All of a sudden, the roads changed from paved to dirt.
And there were open sewers and things like that. So you could really tell. And if you couldn't see that, you could see little kids with bloated bellies that revealed their malnutrition. And it was frightening to me because I had not been exposed to that aspect of our country before. And I had just been to Cambodia. I mean, I literally was in Cambodia within months of the trip to Mississippi, and I saw poverty there. I saw, you know, almost universal poverty, but I did not see the malnutrition and I did not see the misery. Mm-hmm. I saw people coping.
We're getting towards the Vietnam War era now, right? I mean, when was this trip to Mississippi? Was that quite a ways before?
No, that was around 1969, 1970.
Okay. So, and then this is the time when a lot of people, especially college students, were challenging the status quo, a time of massive upheaval, which was reflected in popular music at the time. So I'm going to give us a little flavor of that, put us in that era a little bit. Here's part of a Buffalo Springfield song that became an anthem of the late 1960s and early 70s.
Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
That was Buffalo Springfield, a little anthem of the 1960s and 70s. I'm Eric Jansen. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guest is philanthropist and former ambassador James C. Hormel. So, Jim, how did this social upheaval affect you?
It was stunning to me because in the mid-60s, all these things happened to me almost at once. It was 1965 when my wife and I separated. And in 1966, I made the first tentative efforts at coming out. Meanwhile, I had read a piece by Andy Kopkind in, I think, the New York Times magazine about Vietnam, which exposed me to ideas, thoughts, and facts that I had not absorbed before and made me realize that the war was a sham. Then I started seeing what was going on politically, and it was all very distressing to me. I couldn't feel comfortable in any of those circumstances. Ultimately, I left the University of Chicago, moved to New York, and spent time just sort of dealing with myself. Somebody said, what are you doing in New York? Uh-huh. I said, well, I'm listening to my hair grow.
There's some great photos of you in here, by the way, with long hair. That's great. There's a little section in the middle of the book that has, 10 or 15 pages of photographs. You giving President Clinton a tie.
Oh, yes. He had come to San Francisco with a terrible task. He had to close a naval base, Alameda. While we were waiting, we were standing next to the crew of the Carl Vinson, which is a aircraft carrier that has about 6,000 people aboard. It's like a very small city.
Sure.
And so I'm standing next to this guy, he's 19 years old. I start asking him about his background. He's from Texas. He's got a Hispanic surname. And I said, well, what do you think about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? And he said, you know, there are thousands of us living together on this ship for 6 months at a time. And we have various very restricted tasks to perform, and we must work together and do our job together. He said, I know quite a few people on this ship who are gay, and so does everybody else. And it does not make one bit of difference to us.
So I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but you were a big supporter of President Clinton. As a matter of fact, you were a major donor to his campaign, and that's part of the reason someone suggested that you should pursue an ambassadorship. Then he came along, and he's the one who came up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and he's the one who signed the Defense of Marriage Act. And I'm curious, you know, how you feel about him now and how you feel about those particular actions he took.
Well, those two were really, I think, tragedies. I don't know how else to describe them. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the result of his trying in his very first year as president to do away with the restrictions that prevented gay people from serving in the military. That's what he wanted to do. And he thought he could do it by fiat and discovered suddenly that he could not. And was sort of forced into a corner, and the result was Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
And that was supposed to be some sort of a compromise policy?
Well, it was, and I think people saw it, people who supported it saw it as a way of allowing gay men and women to serve in the military, without having to discharge them. Mm-hmm. What actually happened was that thousands of people were discharged.
You're hearing a conversation with the late James C. Hormel on Out in the Bay, recorded in 2011. He spoke with me then about his life and his tough road to become the nation's first ever openly gay U.S. ambassador. It's detailed in his 2011 memoir, Fit to Serve. He was also a founder and major donor of the James C. Hormel LGBTQIA Center at the San Francisco Public Library in 1996. He gave $500,000 to help create it. It was the first dedicated gay and lesbian center in a U.S. public library. Keep that in mind as you hear the rest of our talk. So let's go back to your story a little bit. You became a Democratic activist, a big supporter of Bill Clinton in 1992 when he was running for president the first time, and he won.
Yes.
Someone suggested to you that you seek an appointment, which at first you thought was odd or wrong in some way. Why should you get some plum assignment just because you gave a lot of money? But then you thought about that and decided to pursue it. So what made you change your mind and decide to pursue it?
Well, first of all, it wasn't any someone. It was Clinton's campaign treasurer. And he also happened to be a gay man. Mm-hmm. And so his suggestion carried some meaning to me. It wasn't frivolous. He said, look at the list of administrative appointments and see if there's something on there that appeals to you and then pursue it. What was compelling about an ambassadorial post was that it required Senate confirmation. And if I went in that direction, I could compel members of the Senate to go on record about LGBT issues, which I thought would be a significant advancement. At least it would bring public attention to issues that were not being talked about. So that led me to make inquiries. I heard from several friends who were in Congress that, you never know what might happen. I decided to find out.
And you found out. Yeah. It was 1992 when you first started making inquiries about, okay, yeah, I think I'd like to be an ambassador. You didn't get appointed until halfway through 1999. So that's 7 years later. And as you described, the first 2 years, you're like, yeah, I can wait. You know, it's just there's a long list he's got to work his way through. And then something happened in 1994 which made you start to be a little more aggressive about your campaign. Is that fair to say?
Well, what happened was that I had been designated for a post, and the post was Fiji. And Fiji, I discovered immediately, had the so-called sodomy laws that were a holdover from the old British colonial days. I ran that by people at the State Department, and they investigated and said they didn't think it should be an impediment. Nonetheless, the word leaked that I had been suggested for this position, there was no apparent reaction in this country. But a couple of months later, there was a very strong reaction in Fiji.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, I think that the president hesitated, and understandably so, because you really don't want to send an ambassador to a country where he or she is not wanted. Meanwhile, in 1994, the Democrats lost control of both the House and the Senate. Jesse Helms, through an assistant on his staff, let it be known that my nomination would not reach the light of day. I think Fiji became out of the question at that point.
So how did it move to Luxembourg?
I had to do some maneuvering. I had to persuade the White House that there were other positions that they could appoint me to that would perhaps establish my credibility. And one of them was the Human Rights Commission in Geneva. There is a delegation that changes its composition every year. And the delegation was headed by Geraldine Ferraro at the time. She was someone who would be supportive of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed to get appointed to a delegate to that commission in 1995.
So you said you were an alternate on that delegation, or you were...
I was an alternate. There were three public members and two congressional members, and the ambassador to the UN.
But that established your... First of all, it gave you a little more experience in that sort of international arena, but it also established a sort of a precedent that, hey, the Senate's already confirmed me once.
Well, sort of, yeah.
Right. At least that was the hope. So how did the Luxembourg post specifically come to your attention, or how did it become offered to you?
Well, I kept pressing because I said, I think the time is ready to do this, is ripe to do this. And the president, you know, was getting in deeper and deeper hot water with the Republicans. He had made several other nominations that sort of fell by the wayside. So I wasn't really confident, but I just had to promote myself, which I'm not very good at. And ultimately, there was somebody on the staff who said, well, you know, where could he appoint you? I said, well, I would look at Western Europe because that's where it would be most difficult to say you can't send a gay person there. And Luxembourg was a very interesting country in between France and Germany, birthplace, as it were, of the European Union. And so I suggested it. And as it turned out, there was an opening for Luxembourg. They asked the government of Luxembourg whether they would approve, and the government said yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So at that point, I was nominated. It was the fall of 1997.
And that's when things got kind of ugly then, right?
Well, I had a hearing, and the hearing went very smoothly.
So you passed the committee, and then a couple of senators put some sort of holds on it, which they can do anonymously, but this, to block it from going to the Senate floor.
That's right.
So who were they, and why did they do this?
Jim Inhofe and Tim Hutchinson. Inhofe of Oklahoma. And the story that I heard, and I have no idea whether it's true or not, was that he had gone to a Wednesday lunch of an extreme, you know, right-wing Republican group, and that somebody had said, you know, the president has nominated this homosexual to be an ambassador, and it should be stopped. Inhofe went back and put a hold on the nomination.
And then at some point, Reverend Luce Sheldon's organization got a hold of this. Andrea Sheldon, his daughter? Or
his daughter, right. She snooped around and found some books which she thought were obscene or whatever she thought, I don't know. And she thought they were offensive in any event. She called public attention to them and said, these books have, you know, the nameplate, James C. Hormel, Gay and Lesbian Center, San Francisco Public Library. He's putting books into our public library that shouldn't be there.
So how did the connection come in that there was some accusations of pedophilia?
The pedophilia charge came from Pat Robertson. Mm-hmm. I had no advance notice that this was going to happen, but one of his 700 club programs was kind of dedicated to this. They put on what really was a totally false show of protest against my nomination. They spoke of a crowd, and the crowd consisted of, I think, about 9 people, led by Christine O'Donnell, the so-called witch from Delaware. So Pat Robertson described me as a pedophile, he pronounced it, a pedophile advocate and a supporter of NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which is just outrageous. I mean, mm-hmm. the charges were without any basis.
And then they also accused of being anti-Catholic because you had been, one of the key pieces of evidence was a videotape of you being interviewed by Jim Gabbert and some reporter.
Ginger Casey, and I knew Ginger. So we were talking, and all of a sudden she said, oh, here come the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. We have to pay attention to these girls. So Ginger said, legend has it that the sisters acquired their habits from a convent in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after telling the nuns that they needed the costumes for a performance of The Sound of Music, at which I laughed. I thought it was funny. And Tim Hutchinson managed to translate that into anti-Catholicism.
These two senators were able to block, and your confirmation never came to the full Senate floor. So eventually President Clinton assigned you during a recess appointment.
Yes, that's right. I think the very day that I was sworn in, it was announced that Tim Hutchinson's wife had divorced him because he had been having an affair with somebody on his staff.
After that long, ugly fight, James Hormel served just 2 years as Luxembourg ambassador, 1999 to 2001. He remained active in politics, philanthropy, and civic life for nearly 2 more decades before passing away August 13th at age 88. You just heard part of a 2011 conversation after the publication of Hormel's memoir, Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. It's still available, and it's a fascinating read. I truly enjoyed meeting and speaking with Jim Hormel. Next week, a conversation with California Supreme Court Justice Martin Jenkins. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, queer radio from SF. To share this show with friends or hear it again and hear past shows, just go to our website, outinthebay.org. You can also sign up there for our occasional email newsletter so you won't miss an episode and subscribe to Out in the Bay podcasts. That's outinthebay.org. You might also make a donation there to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Your gift will help keep LGBTQ voices and stories coming to you and to others who might not be able to give. Just hit the donate tab on our website, outinthebay.org. Thank you. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. This week's show was edited by me, Christopher Beal, and Lucen Mendel. Joanne Marr was the KALW studio engineer for the 2011 recording with James Hormel. Please send us your comments. We'd love to hear from you, outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Really, please let us know what you think, where you are, and how you're hearing us. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay.